Game On.
Game On.
2FM.
You're listening to the Game On podcast. You can join us nightly on 2FM, Monday to Friday from 7. We're going to talk about the 1914 Giro, of all things, next on the programme. Tim Moore will be familiar to many people if you're a fan of cycling books, if you're a fan of travelling books, or a book that combines both. His 2001 publication, French Revolutions, is regarded as many to be amongst the best that combines both. It documented his recreation of the 2000 Tour, which was Lance Armstrong's big comeback. His new book, Geronimo, charts his attempt to take on the 1914 Giro, the reason of which you will learn in a moment. But to start off, this large part is as a result of USADA's reasoned decision against Armstrong and the impact that that certain Texan had on your love of the sport.
And I fell out of love slightly with cycling as a result of the revelations about Lance Armstrong, and I wanted to go back and do something from the nobler age of untarnished heroes.
In deciding to recreate the 1914 Tour, you brought upon yourself possibly the most difficult Giro that has ever existed.
Yes, it was a slightly overambitious project insofar as I thought, okay, well, let's go back and look at a simpler age. I wanted to also, maybe not so much in the way of titanium and 3,000 gears and all this other kind of stuff. Just go back to the basic technology. All right, well, what was the most difficult cycling race in history? So I just literally went to Google, put in most difficult cycling race in history, and instantly it came up with the 1914 Giro d'Italia was without doubt the most severe challenge in the history of professional road race cycling. Of 81 starters, only 8 were able to finish this appalling race. So I thought, there you go, that's my race.
Now, to put all this in context, how prolific a cycler would you be?
I would say not terribly prolific insofar as I haven't really done any sustained cycling since I did my Tour de France thing, which was in the year 2000. So if you tot up my miles over the intervening years, you probably wouldn't be that impressed. I do like bikes and I like watching bikes on the telly in particular, but in terms of cycling, I don't really do more than go to the shops and back these days. It has to be said.
And as with many of us, you started out with great intentions of getting yourself into top physical condition in advance of this, and the reality was you probably weren't fully prepared physically when you landed in Italy.
That's a very diplomatic way of saying I'd done almost no preparation of any sort whatsoever. In fact, I did actually, I got an exercise bike and put it up in our attic and did cycle. I thought this is a good idea. This is a way to kind of keep me kind of motivated. I'll watch the Giro and then later actually the Tour de France, and I will pedal along in sympathy with the riders. But having said that, I never once managed to do more than half of any single stage because it was just too boring. So when I think I set off and started out in Italy on this 100-year-old bike that I'd acquired and sort of vaguely got into road-going condition, I think my principal concession to 21st-century technology was having a sat-nav in order that I didn't get lost all that often. And, of course, I had endless amounts of data on this thing, which did reveal, as I sat on the start line of this 1914 Giro I was going to retrace, that I had done 53 kilometres of preparation.
My lord, I'll be in the diplomatic way I described your physical condition. I'll be more sympathetic now. Your physical preparations were hampered to a great extent by trying to get the bike into one working piece, and the difficulty that seems to exist in recreating a century-old bike. Did it surprise you how hard it was to get all the bits and pieces and get it roadworthy?
Well, it certainly shouldn't have surprised me that much because it represented the most complex technical challenge I've tackled since I last made an Airfix kit, really. So I should have known I was in too deep in many ways. If I just get as many bits as possible from as many ancient bikes as possible, I should be able to make one working bicycle out of them. I say, never having done anything apart from, changing the odd puncture, and if I was feeling really, really advanced, changing the brake blocks or something like that, I'd never done anything like this. But I did manage to, I went all over France picking up bits of old bikes, and the main frame was, which I was very pleased about because I wanted a 1914 bike, obviously, and I did find in this ancient bike market in the middle of France, this guy had actually sort of sellotaped the catalogue, the 1914 catalogue of this bike. So there it was. This is a bona fide 1914 bike. But of course, the principal things about bikes in those days, apart from not having any gears, was that they all had wooden wheels. So I had the original wooden wheels on this 100-year-old bike, but they were utterly riddled with woodworm and warped out of any semblance of circularity. In the end, I found a firm in Italy that still, bizarrely, still makes wooden wheels for bicycles. But when I got in touch with them and ordered them, I said, okay, these are great. And they arrived. I said, okay, but I said, apparently I need special brakes for these wooden wheels because you can't use rubber because the wood gets very hot when you try and say it just melts the rubber. And he said, yes, you need to use cork. I said, all right, have you got any of those? He said, well, you're not going to ride this bike, are you? I said, well, that's kind of the idea. He said, no one makes those anymore. He said, you have to make your own out of wine corks. So that's what I had to do. I had to make my own brake locks out of wine corks, which at least gave me something to do in the evening in terms of sourcing the raw material.
Then to move on in terms of clothing and the garments you were wearing, you went all the way back to recreate them as well.
Yeah, I think it was one of those things that it was the old, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound. I thought, if I'm going to do it properly, I'll really do it properly. I've got the bike with the wooden wheels and everything else, so I might as well completely wear everything to you know, empathise with the full suffering of these guys. And of course, that meant I did find somebody in Italy who kind of still, again, like the wooden wheels, his job appears to be making vintage cycling jerseys. So I'm wearing it right now, I've got to say. It's a very heavy wool sort of roll neck, and the whole outfit is very heavily woolen, which wasn't a massive laugh when I had to wash it every night, and in the vain expectation it might even half dry by the morning. And this big baggy baker's boy cap that passed for my skull protection in terms of descending the Alps without any breaks. And centrepiece things would be, I guess, these big leather side-shielded, blue-lensed kind of welding goggles, really, which is what I covered most of my face with.
Sounds beautiful and all that, but not what you'd want to be wearing going through Italy at the height of temperatures at this time of the year. And I suppose quite suitable back in 1914, because the Giro stages took place during the night, which you declined to take that option.
Clearly, there's two main areas that I feel somehow I kind of cheated a bit, is because the Giro starts, as we can see now, starts at this time of year, at a time of year in northern Italy in particular, which is still prone to having blizzards and other inclement weather conditions. And I, in the 1914 race, the first stage wiped out half the field because it took place in the most appalling weather they'd seen for decades in Italy. And of course, I started in August. So having said that, it wasn't all easy, because when I set off from the start line in Milan, I looked up and they had one of those things outside a chemist with the temperature displayed outside. It said 41 degrees centigrade. So when you're wearing very heavy wool and haven't done any cycling for a long time, that's probably not the digits you want to see.
Do people think you were mental to set out on this?
Yes.
Simple,
briefly.
Simple,
yes, they do. Well, there were plenty of times where I wondered myself whether this was really something that I should be doing, or at least had any reasonable chance of finishing doing, because it was just so, the scale of it was so absurd. And, you know, these guys had done it, wiped out, 90% of the field of people who clearly were honed athletes at the time and attuned to hardship in a way that pampered suburban people like me aren't. So I was telling myself, this is completely insane. On the very first day, my first full day, the saddle, which was the original 100-year-old saddle, completely broke in half, meaning that I had to cycle for the rest of the day, about another 70 kilometres, basically without a saddle, or just this huge rusty bolt between my legs.
So the Savlon was out on day two.
The Savlon was out every morning, actually, I can say that. That's another, because someone said to me, like, shouldn't you have been using pig lard? Yeah. Oh,
there's massively detailed accounts still available of 1914, and you were able to not only chart the route, but chart the challenges and experiences and interactions that the leading riders would have had along the way.
Yes, it was amazing, actually, that this Italian sports journalist, this old guy, some years ago, because it was, you know, still a renowned race for being the hardest ever, he found the guy who won it. He was living in an old people's home and got him to interview him. This guy lived to be 96, which, you know, great advert for doing these things that they did. So he got the full story off him, all of the kind of inside stuff. He actually had a diary he'd kept. So the whole story was there. And it's of course, astonishing. You say it's kind of, you know, the things that they had to put up with then. Apart from the technology they had, i.e. no technology and gravel roads, they also, to fuel themselves, they were riding 400-kilometre non-stop stages starting at midnight, and all they would have to eat were raw eggs. And all they would have to drink, in many cases, by choice, was red wine. So I'm not quite sure how they managed to do it at all.
Yeah, but you then find yourself in this situation, and we join you on this journey through the book of effectively chasing the ghost of Alfonso Calzolari around Italy.
Yeah, he was the guy who ended up winning. It was a rather lovely story, because he was a journeyman. You know, he didn't even start as the leader of his team. He was very much there to support their number one choice rider. He'd only ever won one race, a very small regional race, before he won the Giro. And just through sheer bloody mindedness and determination, he sort of saw everyone off. And I think even at the end, he told the guy who interviewed him, he said, I still can't believe that I did it. And I don't think anyone else could. In fact, he never won another race afterwards.
In a project where you started out almost trying to banish the ghost of Armstrong, our friend Alfonso, is there a possibility that there were a few pharmaceuticals in his system along the way, or certainly a couple of questionable breaches of the rules in the 1914 Giro?
Yes, well, of course, that was, I should have known better, because every time you look into cycling history, trying to find the clean and noble origins of the sport, you're going to be hunting in vain, because it's always really been had its shady characters and dodgy moments. And I was interested to discover, apart from the things I expected, such as, you know, the dirty tricks they got up to try and put the other riders off. They would there were certain sections they all got lost, and they had to carry their bikes up hills. And the guy Alfonso Calzolari, who was in the lead, he managed to somehow sustain two punctures while carrying his bike up a hill, because basically the blokes behind him were just jabbing nails into his tyres as he was walking up the hill. That sort of thing, I suppose you expect. Amazing stuff that he had to put up with, and, you know, people trying to bribe him money to stop him racing. I mean, there were instances when he was caught taking a lift in a car, which he denied, but there were plenty of witnesses, including his own teammate, to say, like, yeah, I saw Alfonso taking a lift from the car, so thanks, mate, for that one. And chemically, in terms of performance-enhancing drugs, it was quite a revelation and an astonishment to discover that their drug of choice in those days was strychnine.
You didn't attempt that, I presume?
No, I did have quite a lot of eggs and a bit of red wine, but I drew the line at strychnine.
So with that number of eggs, God help the person that was downwind of you and the more difficult stages. Just in terms of the reaction you got from the natives, because, you know, you're effectively in some situations, you're rolling in on a 100-year-old bike into a one-horse town, because that time of the year there's very little else going on. Bewilderment seemed to be quite a common theme when you landed in various hotels along your way.
Yeah, I think it was, I mean, it's fair enough. I couldn't really dispute the reaction. I mean, I got a lot of head scratching, but at the same time also people, because in Italy they do really have a particular affection for the what they call the heroic, the golden age of cycling, which goes back to, like, you know, before the wars, when Italian cyclists were really kind of the dominant cyclists in the world. And somehow they've really clung on to this, and so they are much more bike aware, at least kind of old bike aware, than you might expect. So from your average kind of bed and breakfast owner here, and people will come straight out and say, ah, that looks like a 1910, 1915 bicycle. And, you know, wow, they really know their stuff. But at the same time, also lots of them said, you shouldn't be riding that. You should put it in a museum. It's not right.
Physically, what impact did it have on you?
I didn't fall off quite as often as I perhaps deserved to. I did fall off a few times and sustained the usual abrasions. Bearing in mind, I wasn't wearing a helmet, just had a kind of cloth cap on. It could have been a lot worse. Other than that, I think cycling is quite a forgiving exercise, really, in some ways. So it's just, you're just sitting there. There's no stress on your joints. And by the end of it, having done 5 weeks at a roughly average of 100 kilometres a day, I was incredibly fit. Just by default, I'd become a powerhouse by my standards, I've got to say. It was quite remarkable. My legs actually scared me when I looked at them in the shower.
Geronimo, riding the terrible 1914 Tour of Italy, published by Yellow Jersey Press. It's author Tim Moore. Thank you for joining us from Belfast.
Thanks very much indeed. Game over.